everything. Does everything that everything does. Can everything from a web? Yes, it can, because it's everything. Look out. It's Let's Learn
it's
Everything.
It's the Let's Learn Everything show, I'm here to say. We're going to learn things in a major way.
Oh, God. Right.
Nice.
Hey. Hate that.
I don't know. Maybe for season two.
Sorry, is there a season two?
Yeah. Did you not get invited back for season two? Oh, awkward. Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today, we're going to be learning about a science topic, we're going to be answering a science question, and then we're going to be hopping into a little miscellaneous topic. My name is Tom, and today's science topic is something that I think we often take for granted in science, and that is dating.
Right.
Oh, like carbon dating?
Well, yeah, that's the joke. I was going to say we're going to talk about dating techniques. We're going to talk about age differences, because that's obviously very important. But yes, you are right.
Oh, I just straight up ruined that joke. I was like, no, no joke for you.
Not today, Tom.
I'll be fair, not a great joke. But jokes aside, I am very excited because this might be... I know I say this about every topic, but this might be my favorite topic I've researched
so
far.
You literally say that every time, and I don't believe you anymore.
And every time it's true.
Aww.
My name is Ella, and the question you guys will be answering is, what would happen if a human was born in space?
Oh.
Whoa.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin answering that question,
yeah,
so that's really
interesting. I just pictured an astronaut holding like a smaller spacesuit just in the vastness of space.
So cute.
Which is probably not what's gonna happen. Mm-mm. But I'm very curious.
Yeah. My name's Caroline, and the miscellaneous topic this episode is going to be about the history of nail polish.
Oh.
It's a cute one.
That's quite cute.
I gotta say, I love whenever a miscellaneous topic like that comes up, because it's like, I think about it and then I just get like thrown back in time and I'm like, oh my god, wait, where? when does it start? I'm excited to find out. Carbon dating is used in a lot of sciences. It obviously lets us know how old organic objects are, objects that are made out of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly than being useful for science, it's been vital for our podcast. So obviously it's been useful whenever we cover old topics, but it's also been critical anytime we talk about evolution as well, especially human evolution. So carbon dating has had a footnote in many, many of our topics. Anytime, you know, we mention an old date of an organic object, there's probably a good chance that carbon dating has its little fingerprint there. And when you look into how that's possible, like the series of events that give us just that one number is really nuts. I really didn't expect how much was involved in it. And the reason it's probably my favorite topic is because to get to the bottom of that one number, we are going to have to cover a little bit of almost every kind of science to get there. So do y'all know or have any familiarity with how carbon dating actually works?
You know what? I looked it up, and I used to know, and I've completely forgotten. Let me have a guess.
Well, hold on. I would rather... I apologize. I would rather have Caroline's guess with less information, if that's all right.
Fuck knows.
Ella, text me the answer, please.
Ella, let me know now. Ella. I have literally no fucking clue.
Ella, I didn't study.
I'm actually super confident in my answer now. So I think what you do is you isolate the carbon atoms and you count the number of rings.
Like a tree. Like a tree.
Cut it in half.
Cut it. Yeah, right?
I want to say you're technically
Fuck
going
off.
To be slightly correct, indirectly. and I'm very excited to tell you that.
Don't believe you.
You'll see.
No.
We don't cut carbon atoms in half, but I'm very excited to get through this. So we'll get to carbon dating very soon, but I think the best way to think about this is to ask a more general question, which is like, how would you determine how old something is in general?
Ask it.
Nicely. A survey.
Would you compare it to other things that you know?
Oh yeah.
Age?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's generally how it was done. That's generally called relative dating. And that's useful especially when it's like layers of sediment, because generally the principle is things that are deeper are older. But of course that's not very precise, right? Because you just know that something is older, but not by how much. And even then there could be issues with like, you know, changes in the earth.
It's complicated.
Is there something about like how things have degraded in the sample?
That's a very good intuition. And you are correct.
So
we'll get into the technicalities of that. That's a really, great intuition there. So I found a great quote that sort of like breaks down the problem. This is from Janet Ambers from the Encyclopedia of Analytical Science. She goes, devising a usable dating technique requires, first, a characteristic that alters in a known fashion with time. Second, the ability to measure that change. Third, a means of deriving a clean sample, unaltered in other ways. And four, a zeroing mechanism to effectively start the clock. So I find that rubric really thought-provoking because it's just so general, right? It doesn't even mention any specific science. It's not like you have to use chemistry or you have to use physics. It sort of reads like a set of sci-fi rules. And honestly, what they're trying to do is kind of sci-fi, because you're trying to get an object to tell you how old it is.
I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with you. I think like science, any science, like when you like break it down to like its fundamental parts, has like a very basic set of rules to follow.
Yeah.
And this just makes a lot of sense to me that this could be done, that if you can apply these rules to any single like biology, chemistry, physics kind of thing, that it would work. It feels very intuitive to me.
That's good. I'm glad that perspective makes sense to me. I So if I were to put the problem into a single question, it would be, what has been keeping track of time? And so I'll stop asking y'all like these big uncertain questions that I know you don't have the answers to. So I'll switch and ask a question that we all know the answer to, and we're going to build from there. And that is, how do we know how old a tree is?
The rings!
So even though I know we all know this conceptually, I actually learned a ton looking deeper into this. And first, I'm excited to start off with, I learned a beautiful new science word, and that is dendrochronology.
Okay.
Which is the scientific discipline concerned with dating and interpreting past events based on the analysis of tree rings. So first thing I learned about dendrochronology is that you don't have to actually cut the whole tree down to count the rings. They use this like tiny drill that they spin by hand, and then they pull a core section out that's about like the thickness of a pencil.
Oh, interesting.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
You don't have to completely kill it to be like, oh yeah, that one was the however
many pencil. Anymore.
Not anymore. And what's really interesting is also they do a similar method with the Earth, right? When they core and pull a sensor of the Earth out and count the layers. I just thought that was interesting.
But they count the layers of the Earth. Like, it's not like a layer per year, right?
No, exactly. But there are, you know, like when it comes to like the ice age or changes in climate. I just thought that was an interesting parallel.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you do have a great intuition there, because what makes the tree rings special is that it happens on an annual basis. And do you know why that works in the first place? Like how these rings form?
Oh fuck, I should know the answer to this.
Is it seasonal changes?
Yeah. There you go. So it's caused by how the trees grow. And also, this is another thing I've always wondered, and I'm so glad I got an excuse to learn it. So trees have tissues called meristems that are responsible for growth. There are apical meristems, so that's how the tree grows long ways. And then there's lateral meristems, which is how it grows wider. So apical meristems are how the tree grows like up and how branches grow out and how roots grow down. And then the lateral meristems are responsible for like the widening of the bark. And like you said, Ella, the reason this happens in annual rings is because a year is an orbit around the sun. And because the Earth is on a tilt, it has seasons. And those seasons cause the amount of growth to be different throughout the year. And so it forms these rings. And that's why tropical trees have less pronounced rings, because there's less seasonal change.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But they do have some because of, you know, seasonal, like rain seasons and dry seasons. But right. I just thought that was really interesting. Obviously, climate factor is like a huge thing in ring formation. And like the thickness of rings. It's all actually like really like surprisingly intricate. I found this one flow chart that was like truly bonkers about being like how this all interconnects together. But that's the gist of it, right? And what's amazing is I never realized how much I took that for granted until I read this section of a textbook from Fritz Schweingruber. I'm going to paraphrase it, but he basically says, like, every living creature has fluctuations in growth, but very few of these happen on, like, a regular cycle. Mm. And if it does happen on a regular cycle, it's only usually for, like, a few years. And so this is a quote, trees with annual growth increments are a major exception to this. And on top of that, trees are widely distributed over the Earth. So trees are the exception. Most organic things don't keep track of time reliably for a long time. But the idea behind carbon dating is, what if they secretly were?
The secret life of carbon.
That's a good title for the episode. So the idea of carbon dating came about around 70 years ago, and I found multiple papers describe that time as the radiocarbon revolution, because it just changed so many fields and everyone was just like scrambling to be like, let's measure this. But what I found most interesting as I was trying to understand this is that carbon dating isn't really a single idea. It's actually three different scientific ideas that you combine together to get carbon dating.
Okay.
And so we're going to break them down. Can you guess what any of those three are?
Retrieving the carbon.
I was going to say isolating the carbon in some way, surely, would be.
Interesting. This makes me very happy because the concepts are a lot more general than that. So to understand carbon dating, we're going to have to first learn about space, life, and radioactivity.
Fun! Cool.
And somehow after knowing those things, we will be able to tell how old organic material is before written history. And I think that's amazing. So we have to do radioactivity first. And radioactivity for me has always been a really confusing concept, but I finally had to learn it for the podcast. Thank you, podcast, for forcing me to learn something. Learning the tree stuff was like my dessert, and like radioactivity was my broccoli, but radioactive elements are elements that are unstable. Like if you imagine a carbon nucleus as like 12 neatly grouped tennis balls just like wobbling around, because we know from the thermobiology episode that like atoms are all jiggling around. An unstable element would be like having one extra tennis ball just like thrown in there, sort of throwing everything off balance. Mm-hmm. Or it could be an element that's made of like 100 tennis balls, and so the whole thing is like entirely unstable. And that's why all the heaviest elements on the periodic table are all radioactive. You know, that like bottom bar at the bottom of the periodic table where it's like, don't touch those. It's like the danger. It's because they're just so big, they can't be stable. And so because they're unstable, one day, maybe years and years from now, that like extra tennis ball, those unstable bits are going to pop off. And it's going to decay, like Caroline said. It's sort of like if you had like a rock in your shoe, and each step you're like, maybe it'll come out now. Maybe eventually this annoying little wobbly bit will finally come loose, and then I'll be back to stable. And obviously, this idea has big implications for, you know, power generation. Blah blah blah. Radioactivity is its own topic and a half for another time. But what's important for us, and you might remember this from the randomness episode, is that this decaying happens at a statistically consistent rate, mm-hmm. known as the half-life. So if you had a shoe full of 100 pebbles, the half-life is the time it would take for 50 of those pebbles to fall out. Kind of stretching the metaphor a bit, but I hope you get the point. The half-life is how long it takes for those extra tennis balls to pop off and shake loose. And it's different for different elements. So the half-life of uranium is 4.5 billion years. And the half-life of the element francium is 22 minutes, which I didn't realize that it could be that varied.
This is actually, for once, something I understand, because I worked with radioactive material in my PhD. Specifically, iodine-125,
ooh,
which has like a pretty short half-life. It's like 60 days.
It's really nuts, and I wish we could... I mean, we'd have to take a whole chemistry lesson to understand exactly what it makes these things so varied, but it's really wild. So the idea is that, right, if you know the half-life of a radioactive element and you know how much of it has decayed already, you know how long since it's been formed.
Oh, okay.
Right. In a sense, radioactive things can work like clocks because they decay at a constant rate. And that's great. And if every prehistoric human buried their remains with freshly minted uranium, that would be all we needed. But that didn't happen. So what we need now, ideally, is an element that is organic, so that like it's in living things, has a long half-life so that it can keep track for a long time, is constantly being newly made so that radiation clock starts at zero.
I know this one.
Ella, I'm so glad. I'm gonna ask you to. I wanna throw this surprise at Caroline, but I'm so glad you know this. And the last thing is, it has to be like not super harmful to us. So preferably there has to be like some of it, but not like so much that the radiation is dangerous to us. That seems like an impossibly tall order for there to be this element that does like all of these things, but it does exist. And it exists for the most amazing reason. And Ella was doing a little dance, and I think that's because she knows where this is going. So Caroline, on the other hand, is very confused.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited to tell you. So the element is called carbon-14.
Okay.
And carbon-14, it's like regular carbon with two extra neutrons. So its atomic mass goes from 12 to 14. Hence, carbon-14.
So it's got 14 tennis balls rather than 12 tennis balls.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And those extra neutrons want to shake loose and radiate and decay. And it does so with a half-life of 5,730 years, which is pretty good. It's better than iodine-125. and it's actually better than most sort of like organic radioactive elements, which have half-lives of like hours or days. So it's amazing. And last, it is naturally being produced all the time on Earth.
So is that the thing we use for carbon dating?
It is.
So does that mean we can't carbon date anything before like around 6,000 years ago? Because that's its half-life, isn't it? Ignore me.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and the more you have of the sample, obviously, the easier it is to carbon date. We'll get into that.
But that means there is a time limit.
Exactly. Yes, and we'll get into that.
Interesting.
So this magical lucky element is also lucky because it's being newly produced all the time on Earth. And I want to ask, and Ella, do you know the answer to this?
No.
Oh, okay, so...
I remember, I knew it was carbon-14. That was the thing I knew.
Oh.
I remembered.
I'm sorry.
You took that from me, Tom.
No, this is great. Well, Ella, what's better than a wonderful surprise? So, this is going to be like a little magic trick. So, do you guys know how it's made? So, I'll give you guys a hint. So, the way carbon-14 is formed is it starts off as nitrogen-14, and then a neutron bumps a proton off and replaces it.
Oh.
Okay.
Is this where the space comes in?
Right.
Oh my god, is it cosmic rays?
It is.
No way! Oh my god!
I was gonna say, where could we get a constant stream of neutrons to hit all this nitrogen?
Oh my god, that's actually made my day.
When you did that topic last time, at first I was like, oh no, is this going to ruin my topic? And then I was like, no, this is perfect. I don't have to explain cosmic rays.
Yay!
So this is a quote from a paper in 1963, and it goes, the production of carbon-14 in the atmosphere by the interaction of cosmic ray neutrons with nitrogen was first suggested by Montgomery and Montgomery in 1939, after the discovery of neutrons in the cosmic radiation by Loscher and Lachar in 1933.
I can't believe this didn't come up when I was like researching cosmic rays.
Well, and I think the reason why, Elle, is because it's such a like... Do you guys know the board game Mousetrap, where it's like a Rube Goldberg? The number of steps it takes to get to carbon dating is so intricate that it would take too many steps, I think, for something to explain it. Like, I mean, this is the reason why anytime like a science article mentions carbon dating, they would need to take like three paragraphs to explain how that works. And so they're just like, carbon dating. So Ella, for those who haven't listened to the last episode, do you want to explain what cosmic rays are?
Okay.
Briefly.
Very briefly. Cosmic rays are high energy particles from outer space, different parts of space. The higher energy ones come from further out, like outside of the galaxy. And then when they enter the Earth's atmosphere, they collide with particles in the atmosphere, which leads to other particles being rained down upon Earth.
And some of those particles are carbon-14. And so of all the carbon on the planet, the percentage of carbon-14 in nature is 1/10 trillionth of a percent.
Wow.
So that's 10 zeros after the decimal place.
Wow.
Which is good, actually, because it's a big enough percentage that we can measure it, but also it's small enough that it's not super harmful to us, that we don't all have, like, constant radiating carbon.
Science is fucking sick, bro.
I'm so glad. That's how I felt during this. I was like, what is happening? So we have radioactivity, we have space. The last thing we need to learn is the cycle of life and death. Can y'all guess how this completes the puzzle?
We have carbon in us.
That's correct.
Then will we die? No, that's as far as I'm getting.
So are y'all familiar with the idea that every cell in our body is replaced every 7 years? Have you heard that factoid before?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not true, but
it's we don't. That's like a separate question for another episode. We don't have time to get into the specifics of it. But it's like semi true, and it is true for carbon. Basically, what happens is that in the Earth there is a carbon cycle, and it's a lot slower than the water cycle. But you know, carbon goes from the atmosphere to the plants, to the ground, to the dirt, to the water, to animals, and it moves. And so there is the same roughly amount of carbon-14 in our bodies as there is just like ambiently in the atmosphere.
Right.
And there is also a carbon cycle that's happening within us. Right. It's not exactly 7 years, but we do recycle a lot of material. And so,
okay, I see what you see. Yeah,
every time we eat, every time we breathe out, every time we defecate, when we lose dead skin cells, the carbon in us is coming in and leaving. We take in carbon and we breathe it out, and so when we stop breathing, when we die, that cycle stops. And so when living things die, they stop this carbon cycle in their bodies, and so the amount of carbon-14 is just locked in. Because normally when we're alive, we're like taking it out, we're taking in like new carbon-14, and so it's sort of like we're constantly eating little stopwatches, and we normally poop them out, but when we kick the bucket, they stay in us and they get to keep ticking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So to put it all together, cosmic rays bombard the atmosphere. This creates radioactive carbon-14. Living organisms constantly take in new carbon-14 and stop when they die. Therefore, we can use the little radioactive clocks created by space that stay with us when we die to know how long ago something died.
Wow. Love that. Amazing. Amazing.
Caroline is just blinking into space.
How do we find the carbon-14, like, in the dead things?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because, of course, this theory works, but we still have to put the idea to the test. So this is honestly such a beautiful and hilarious test, and it very deservedly won the Nobel Prize. So in 1947, Anderson and Libby realized that if all of the previous things were true, then old things should have much less carbon-14 than new things, right? But the problem is, at the time, the technology wasn't advanced enough to just, like, take an old bone and a new bone and count the carbon-14, because remember, carbon-14, it's 1/10 trillionth the percent of all carbon, so it's a lot harder to measure. And so they have to use a form of carbon that they can concentrate so that they can accurately measure it. So there's different methods for this, Caroline. You can either, like, measure the radiation that comes out, sort of like a Geiger counter. But these days there's something called accelerator mass spectrometry, which lets them, like, separate and actually measure the amount of carbon-14 in a sample. But at the time, you know, they just figured this out. They're like, how do we do this? And so what they do is they have to use a form of carbon they can concentrate so that it's more obvious, they can measure it more easily. And so they use methane, which is a gas that has carbon in it, and so it will have carbon-14. So where would you get old methane, and where would you get new methane?
New methane is from cow farts.
I was going to say exactly the same thing. And then could old methane be, like, in the ground?
Exactly.
Somewhere? Yeah, it's going to be like a... Yeah. Is it like geysers or...
Yeah.
You know, like oil or something, I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, you guys are spot on with this. So the source for old methane was crude oil, which is made from old, dead organic matter. It's easy to forget that, but in this case, it's perfect. And for new methane, this is a quote from Libby's address at the Nobel Prize ceremony. It goes, "We used methane gas from the sewage disposal plant of the city of Baltimore."
Oh, nice.
Fun.
Nice. I just love that in a Nobel Prize address, he was like, "Shout out to Baltimore Sanitation Department. Couldn't have done without you. This prize goes to you.
Shout out to the people of Baltimore for shitting so much."
A part of me is a bit sad that they didn't use cows and then thank the cows in their speech. Yeah. Yeah.
But in another way, it's like, it's honestly like genius, because you have, like, these two things, like oil and sewage, which already exist in, like, the perfect form for this. And of course, the new sewage methane had more carbon-14 than the old oil methane. And that's how we got carbon dating.
Was nice.
From Baltimore poop. So a few years after that, in 1949, they actually start carbon dating objects. And this is where it gets very exciting for them. So they used objects they already had historical records for so that they could confirm their accuracy. So, like, wood from a coffin of a recorded, like, famous death of a pharaoh. And this paper has one of my favorite graphs I've seen, because I can just, like, feel the excitement coming off of it. I'll send you guys a quick picture, but I'll also describe it. So this graph, basically, they just got a bunch of old things and they put it on a graph. And so this chart literally reads Pompeii, the Pharaoh Snefru, the Bible, and a redwood tree, all on the same graph.
Nice.
And you can just tell the glee, because they're just like, "Oh my god, we can carbon date anything." Like, what? How about that old Egyptian artifact? Or, like, what if we call up Sheila from the British Museum and see if we can get her old Bible?
Right. Are all these ones at the bottom of this graph? So Hemaka, Zet, Sneferu, yes, and are they all like pharaohs? Like, they yes, sound, yeah, like, yeah, they're, yeah, all pharaohs. Nice, that's sick.
That's really,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, they're literally just like, get any old thing we can and test
the
it.
The only graph where you're going to see a pharaoh and a tree on the same axis.
Yeah.
I love that.
And the Bible.
Yeah, and the Bible.
It's really
it
wild.
Also has their oldest point here. Oh, no, they're only going to 5,000 years.
Well, so this is the thing, Ella, and I'm glad you noticed that. So this is a quote from the Nobel address that, like, really puts this shift into context. So Libby's basically describing this process where he's making this graph, and he goes, The first shock Dr. Arnold and I had was when our advisors informed us that history extended back only to 5,000 years. We had thought initially that we would be able to get samples all along the curve back to 30,000 years, put the points in, and then our work would be finished. You read statements in books that such and such a society or archaeological site is 20,000 years old, but we learned rather abruptly that these numbers, these ancient ages, are not known accurately. In fact, it is about the time of the first dynasty in Egypt that the first historical date of any real certainty has been established. So we have to take into context that at the time, before carbon dating, these were the farthest back accurately we could get solid numbers, which is only 5,000 years ago. It's only with carbon dating that we get to take that like huge step back in time. And so I want to ask, do you know how far back carbon dating goes? Can go.
Do you know what the curve, the half-life curve looks like? I don't suppose you know,
offhand?
Do you? Yeah.
I'm flattered you think I'm that smart, but no, I don't offhand.
Because they're, like, most radioactive decay curves follow, like, two, like, basic, like, shapes. Short ones, which drop very quickly and then have, like, a little more flatter dip at the bottom. And then the long ones, which are kind of like, how do I describe this in a in word form?
It's sort of like a steeper, but not as steep as like the quicker ones.
It's not like a straight line. It dips, but then like this. But so if you said it's 5,000 years is the half life of this of carbon 14, yeah. I don't know, 50,000 years.
Oh, God.
You were spot on, weren't you, Ella? Yeah.
I am sick and tired of your called shots. This is really... after the last episode with the color eye color thing where you literally got every single number, I'm sick and tired of your educated guesses. My God. holy wow. So...
Okay, nice. Well done!
In the first experiment from 1949, Libby said, quote, "It is hoped that during the next year, a decisive test of the method for the prehistoric periods up to 20,000 years will be obtained."
Nice.
And then in 1998, that number hit 24,000. In 2009, it hit 50,000. And very recently in 2020, so 2 years ago, it got bumped to 55,000.
Wow.
I can't.
Nice. That really was just, I wouldn't even say that's an educated guess. Like, I would say that is just like a straight up guess. I remember what radioactive curves look like, but that was just like, okay, so if a half-life is, you know, if you're reading off a curve, I was like, okay, that must be like something like 10 times the amount.
Wow, okay.
But that's we're just bull... semi bullshit, so don't
I'll put that to some intuition there. But in some specific cases, you know, where either the amount of carbon is like there's a ton of it, so you can get a bigger sample, or we know more about the context, it has gone as far back as 75,000 years.
Wow.
Oof.
So we can also use that same idea with other radioactive elements to measure older things like fossils. And even the age of the Earth itself. So in those cases, it's not carbon dating, it's just called radiometric dating. So just using whatever similar principles, but with different radioactive materials.
Oh.
But yeah, it's really hard not to go on and on and on and on and on about like all the cool things that we now know how old they are. But of course, carbon dating isn't perfect. And you can find easily dozens of articles with like flashy headlines out there. I found one in particular that I thought was hilarious. It's titled "Carbon Dating Accuracy Called into Question After Major Flaw Discovery."
Dun dun dun.
New research conducted by Cornell University could be about to throw the field of archaeology on its head.
Oh my God.
If this is true, then many of our established historical timelines are thrown into question, potentially needing a rewrite of the history books.
Wow.
Right.
Do you guys want to know what the discrepancy was in years that this article is talking about?
Desperately.
So if you continue reading past that headline, the article itself goes, "The team led by archaeologist Stuart Manning identified variations in the carbon-14 cycle at certain periods of time, throwing off timelines by as much as 20 years.
Oh, no. Not, God. Not 20 years.
Damn it. Our entire God. Understanding of history has been thrown into turmoil.
When
what
I'm dating
we do?
Something that's 40,000 years old, that 20 years is really going to make a difference, you know? That's going to change timelines. I'm going to have to put...
I didn't even know it could get that accurate. You know, but it is true that there are, you know, variations in carbon dating. We've just learned it involves space, life, and radioactivity, so there's a lot of room for variability. So, for example, smaller samples have less carbon-14, so that it can be harder to measure. The Industrial Revolution affected the amount of carbon-14.
Oh, shit.
And it has a named effect. It's known as the Seuss effect because we've taken it into account, but it is a thing. Mm. Similar thing happened with nuclear bomb testing, which is known as the Libby effect. Changes in climate over time can affect how much carbon-14 there is. That's made by cosmic rays. There's also something known as a reservoir effect, where waterlogged materials can have the amount of carbon-14 change.
This might be completely off base. Does ice, like melting ice, release carbon? Or is that something...
That could definitely be an issue. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, anything that changes the amount of carbon changes the amount of carbon-14 indirectly.
I assume now, with like deforestation, which also releases a lot of carbon... That can also change it for future historians too.
Absolutely. Yeah. The use of fossil fuels and the changes to, I mean, you know, because we talk about, right, climate change is directly related to the amount of carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And carbon dioxide is carbon. And so that changes this carbon cycle. So yeah.
Future historians get fucked.
Well, hopefully let's just bury ourselves with uranium. Hopefully that'll be good. But you know, there have been corrections in the past that have moved things back like as much as 1,000 years in time from initial calculations. So that does happen. But while some articles, like the one I mentioned, find this to be like a bad thing or like a worrying thing about carbon dating, I honestly think it's amazing because any improvement to this already bonkers idea is amazing to me. Like, when I was researching this, one thing I really wanted to give you guys was like a solid number on how accurate carbon dating is today. I wanted to be like, carbon dating is accurate within plus or minus X years. But I couldn't find it because it's just so complicated and varied and context dependent. And I think that's a good thing, actually. Right. You're going to have to endure another one of my metaphors.
I love them, Tom. I love them.
Carbon dating is like a rainbow because it...
Aww.
No. it's like friendship. Carbon dating is like friendship.
It decays over time.
Oh my God.
The question, how accurate is carbon dating today, is kind of like asking how tasty is food today, right? Food has gotten objectively better. And sometimes that's because of a big technical shift, but most of the time it's because of a million smaller local changes that happen. Mm. And it's the same with carbon dating. I want to show you my absolute favorite example of a local, super specific scientific discovery that changed the carbon dating scale. So this is a quote from a paper by David Wright in 2017, and it goes, OES... is commonly subject to radiocarbon dating in the African context. There is a relative abundance of OES in archaeological deposits after 40,000 years ago. It is quite durable as a material, it does not decompose as easily as bone, and most labs have no trouble processing samples. Do you know what OES is?
No.
No.
OES stands for ostrich eggshell.
Oh my... That's amazing.
So, once again, we have yet another completely different science to help us improve carbon dating. And all of these clues from the other sciences help us form something called a calibration curve, which is basically like one big mathematical model to try to make our estimates of carbon-14 better. In 1986, the first international calibration curve was made, known as INTCAL, and it's still being updated today with data from...
Wow.
All over the world. You can actually use it as a package in the programming language R.
Oh,
And it really is international. In the most recent update that came out in 2020, it's known as IntCal 20, they included data from stalagmites from underwater caves in the Bahamas.
Nice.
That's so cool.
But the thing, I'm so excited, the thing that made me the happiest to read was the very first sentence of that paper. So this is from the 2020 paper unveiling the new IntCal. The main backbone of radiocarbon calibration has been and will continue to be tree rings. Yay! Dated by dendrochronology.
We love that. Aww.
When I was researching this and I found that, I could not believe how full circle this whole story was.
We love that for trees.
Go trees.
This completely new technology that involves space and everything, still, like, they're like asking trees, they're like, hey, can we have some of your answers for the homework, please? So, after all this time. And so this is also interesting. So the oldest tree that they've used to calibrate was a bristlecone pine tree that's like 5,000 years old. But, quote, by matching up the relative widths of rings from one tree to another, including from bogs and historical buildings, the tree record has now been pushed back 13,910 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Even though any individual tree is only, say, 1,000 or 2,000 years old, they can match the rings together like puzzle pieces to extend it 13,000 years back. That, for me, has been like the best part of all this, is that you have contributions from nuclear chemists, geologists, paleontologists, computer scientists, mathematicians, and also dendrochronologists, like puzzle piecing together trees from bogs.
That's so cool.
And all working together to try to make this wild idea work to help us try to turn back time. Like, behind this single number saying how old something is science from every possible field from all across the world. That IntCal paper from 2020 that I mentioned has 40 authors from Scotland, Sweden, Switzerland, New Zealand, China, the Netherlands, Germany, the US, the UK, and Australia.
Wow.
And the perfect summation of why I find this all so beautiful is this quote from a conference paper by Emily Jaeger in 1979, where she said, "This is a discipline that lies between the earth sciences, physics, and chemistry. It is therefore the ideal discipline for teamwork."
Aww.
So I wasn't wrong when I said that the real Carbon 14 was the friends we made along the way.
Lame. You ruined the whole topic.
We're really done with your shit now, Tom. Just putting that out there.
That was so fun.
That was really, really good.
I don't know what I expected you to talk about, but I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I'm glad. Oh, I'm so glad.
I wasn't expecting it to go in the direction that it did go in. That's for sure.
So today's question is, what would happen if a human were born in space? I guess a better question might be, could a human be born in space?
Yeah, that's true. That is also that. Well, wow. Wait.
Oh. Huh.
I want to, before we start talking about it, I'm going to establish like the rules of this question, which is
okay.
Which is just
wait, yeah, like what is
like the where, basically, by space.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, like the International Space Station.
Yeah.
Or like satellites. Or shuttles orbiting Earth, not deep
somewhere
space.
Somewhere with, like,
okay,
very little gravity, but not, like, that far away from us.
Yeah,
basically.
So, like,
yeah.
The ISS is in geostationary orbit, about 400 kilometers from the surface of Earth. So that level of space.
Okay.
Just because otherwise it gets too complicated.
Sure, 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 sure.
Would the lack of gravity prevent the baby from, like, turning around inside the womb as it's supposed to, and then causing like some kind of breach in pregnancy?
You know what? I didn't read anything about that, but like the lack of gravity obviously is an immediately like obvious issue.
Yeah.
I will also, I imagine the data you're pulling from this aren't space birth records. They are more theoretical that...
I mean, maybe. Maybe not. I don't know.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
But yeah, Caroline, I'm trying to, I want to try to like brainstorm like what are the the problems with space. I think you're right that zero gravity is the biggest one.
Like, how do you push a baby out when there's no gravity? Like, what the fuck? How are you supposed to get comfortable? Or is it easier?
Well, my housemate actually asked me that question, because that was like the first thing he thought of when I told him this. And I actually don't think the birth in space would be one of the major issues. Most of birth is like a physical part of the human body, like contractions and pushing.
That's a great point.
So I don't necessarily, I'm not sure, I'd have to look that up, but I don't necessarily think that that's been considered to be a big issue.
I just feel like a baby on a space station is a bad idea, you know? Like, a little floating around tiny being that's just gonna, like choking on vomit that it's, like...
Oh, my
like,
gosh.
Not able to get rid of because it's got gravity.
Jeez, yeah, you're thinking,
I'm going into this now.
Yeah. Okay, I think there are two...
You can't stack blocks to play with because it's zero gravity?
What about, like, the baby's spine? Because, obviously, like, no gravity.
Oh, my gosh.
You're hitting...
Development.
Definitely points.
We can say for sure, definitely points.
Because there are like three parts to, you know, being born in space, and that's like fertilization.
Oh.
Gestation. Oh.
And then
actual birth and being like alive in space as a baby.
So it turns out zero gravity really, really throws a wrench into everything.
Yeah, and gravity is like the main issue here. That's the thing we're going to get into the most. But before we start talking about it, I'll just say that the gravity on the ISS is actually almost the same as on Earth. It's like 90% of Earth's gravitational force.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, is that true?
But, yeah, it's true, because it's not actually that far away. It's only like a tenth of the way to the moon.
Yeah, yeah.
But astronauts float because the ISS is revolving around the Earth at 8 kilometers per second, which essentially is...
Really?
They're constantly being in free fall. So this is called microgravity.
Oh, so it's like the vomit comet plane.
Yeah.
But just continuous.
Yeah, it feels like zero gravity to them. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's changed everything.
No, it hasn't really, because it's still, their bodies are still experiencing zero gravity.
Yeah, you're right, like in the physics diagram, they are identical, basically.
That's just going to be a dumb piece of information that I'm going to use to ruin people's days, basically, is what that is.
So... I was going to say, Ella, like, the place that my intuition for this comes from is the fact that I do know that, like, they have to, like, actively work out on when they're in space, because otherwise their bones and their muscles will atrophy because there's no downward force that's, like, working on it. And I do also know that I believe birds can't exist in space for very long because they use gravity to help them swallow food.
Oh. I actually didn't see that, but I believe you.
I just want to, like, start from, like, the insemination point. Because I have thoughts.
So let's start from...
I want to start with the most important thing, which is, what do you name a space baby? Stella? Stella's a good one.
Stella is
Apollo's a good one. Luna's a good one. We'll come up with more.
Yeah.
Yeah, just throw them out there as we go. Okay, this has been a very chaotic start, and I can see we have a lot of thoughts. So let's narrow ourselves down to what Caroline was just saying. We'll start with inception, fertilization. How do you think space may affect fertilization of an egg, sperm and egg?
My first thought is, like, back on Earth, in terms of, like, safe sex and talking about things like that, we heavily suggest not using, like, gravity or showering afterwards and things like that as, like, a form of contraceptive, because gravity doesn't really have that much of a stopping effect.
That's a great point, Caroline.
That's
so
true.
I wonder how much the lack of gravity actually impacts that.
Is the ISS a safe form of contraception?
I wonder, does gravity impact egg release at all?
Or is that still the same process? I don't think so.
Yeah. In which case, I'm going to say fertilization still happens in a similar sort of way then.
Okay, and Tom, do you think fertilization happens in space?
Yeah, having listened to everything Caroline said, I'm going to pretend that I already knew that and also agree.
So there's only one thing that maybe throws a spanner in the works there. There's a study of sea urchins reproducing in space.
Ah.
And this...
excuse me? Or like, I'm well, sorry, what?
Actually, I should say not reproducing in space, because that's...
Attempting to.
Yeah, sea urchin sperm motility is like significantly inhibited in low gravity for some reason.
Oh, whoa. Interesting.
Okay, I will say also in pro this working is the fact that I believe different animals have different forms of like sperm strategy. So some have like bigger ones that are more likely to successfully make it. And I know our strategy as humans is to have just like a ton of sperm, right? So yeah. It's not like there's like a lone sperm that like in zero gravity is getting lost in space. There's a bunch.
Also, yeah. Are sea urchins like whatever, I assume semen? Does that go into water, or is that like an internal?
I think it's released into water, which is one of the
that
issues,
might
right?
Impact it. Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of things to consider here with fertilization. Gravity actually is probably the least of our worries when it comes to fertilization in space.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because one of the big things that would affect not just fertilization but every stage of this is radiation.
Oh.
So on Earth, we're protected from the large majority of like harmful radiation by the atmosphere and the magnetosphere.
Thanks, atmosphere.
Thanks, magnetosphere.
Shout out.
But radiation is like 50 to several thousand times higher in space. But...
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say percent, but you're like, no, times.
Yeah, I mean, it's much, much worse. But the ISS still receives some of the Earth's magnetic protection, so it's not going to be the same
cool.
sending material into like deep space. But there has been a really interesting study on this recently.
Oh.
So because there's the idea that there could be an issue of fertility being infected in space by mutating sperm and eggs. So in 2021, Terahiko Wakayama and his team at the University of Yamanashi used freeze-dried mouse sperm that had spent 6 years on the International Space Station, and then they brought it back to Earth.
Oh, that's so smart.
Yeah.
That's so smart. Yeah.
No, I just, the fact that they had frozen mouse sperm on the International Space Station for 6 years is fucking with my brain.
So funny. It's so
hold
funny.
Hold on. Yep. Never mind. Great point. Ted, don't open that freezer. Don't. That's not food in there. Trust me. Wait another 5 years and then we're ready. I'm just mad that somehow you beat sea urchin space sex with freeze-dried mouse sperm.
Honestly, there's going to be so much weird stuff on this.
I am so excited.
So they brought the freeze-dried mouse sperm back to Earth, and they successfully fertilized mouse eggs, and then they were carried to term in female mice.
Yeah.
So the sperm did have like a little bit of DNA damage, but the pups were healthy and had normal gene activity, and then when they grew up, they also went on to have healthy progeny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because isn't it the case that like most of our DNA is non-coding? So like a level of damage isn't going to impact it that much. That makes sense.
I didn't know that, but that makes sense. That's cool.
Freeze-drying sperm is supposed to protect it from radiation about tenfold, because it completely removes water. And and the big reason we get mutations in DNA is because radiation splits water into the unstable radicals that Tom was talking about, and that causes damage in a cell. The reason I really wanted to bring up this story is because Wakayama was quoted as saying, the sperm became a powder resembling instant coffee. Wow.
Why would he say that? It's okay to think these things, but writing them down, and then the publisher going, you know what, yeah, that's okay to leave
that's
them there.
That's a great point, Caroline! That's a great point! Like at least five people in the train had to go, ew, okay.
Okay.
Ew. Not sure.
Ew.
I did have the thought about astronaut ice cream, and so I'm glad someone...
I went frozen yogurt.
Let's continue.
So I'm so
glad. Oh, good. Let's continue.
Well, but like I said, if we want to do this in deep space, freeze drying might not be as effective just because of the level of radiation is much higher. But then we, like you guys were getting at before, we need to think about gravity. I think the idea here is just to see, can fertilization of mammals actually occur at zero gravity? There was a study which they used it's called a 3D clinostat, which it's a machine that like mimics weightlessness by rotating objects in such a way that it...
Oh, so smart. Duh.
The effects of gravity are spread in like every direction.
That makes
sense. So specifically it was simulating 10 to the minus 3G.
Oh, wow.
We obviously experienced 1G. And they had sperm in there and eggs. They fertilized the mouse eggs and cultured the embryos all in the clinostat.
Oh, wow.
And then they implanted those eggs into female mice in normal gravity. And some offspring were produced and did survive, but it was like a much lower rate than at regular gravity, which suggests that regular gravity is kind of needed for that healthy embryo development in the early stages.
Oh, okay.
I think that's not surprising, but they don't specifically know why.
That is really clever.
That is
and
really
I also
cool.
These all make sense because when you were like, well, maybe they did have, there was some impregnation in zero gravity. I was like, how is that? I was literally just like, how is that possible? But like using sea urchins and using simulated zero gravity, this is so clever. Yeah.
I do want to like add the caveat that all of these are like only partially completed in space or at zero gravity. We've never seen mammals fully reproduce or develop in space.
Sure.
There was one paper that reported they sent a 2-cell mouse embryo into space aboard the Columbia shuttle, and it just failed to develop completely. In the 1970s, Soviets sent rats into orbit aboard the Cosmos 1129 satellite, and there was evidence that they had mated, but none of the females ever delivered. And it's kind of unclear whether or not they didn't carry to term or if they even got pregnant, because there's also evidence that male rats on the Cosmos 1887 satellite had a lower sperm count than Earth controls.
There's so many factors.
And that brings us back to the sea urchin thing, maybe motility, radiation, all this stuff that kind of plays into it.
Right. Turns out there's a lot of factors to get into space.
So mammals haven't had a great success in reproducing or fertilizing in space, but non-mammalian animals have had a lot of success. Can you guess what animals have successfully reproduced in space?
God, what would they take to space?
Ella, I want you to tell me it's space bees.
If only it was space bees.
Oh,
it's not. I have to say, it's not space bees or space naked mole rats.
Oh,
let's go through the list of our favorite animals.
Some of these are very intuitive to me as someone who studied biomedical science, and maybe that will give you a.
I'm out of luck.
Frogs.
They have done frogs.
They've done frogs.
We gave birth to a space frog.
My thought was because we use it so often as like a model species. That
you're on the
great point.
The examples I have here, you're on the exact right track.
Oh shoot! What else do we use?
So it's one of my favorite model organisms here.
Oh, fruit flies.
Oh. Yeah,
nailed it.
Wow! Hey, y'all, listeners, that's real friendship. What's your favorite model species?
If we play the Mr. and Mrs. game on Patreon, that has to be one of the questions.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
That
makes sense.
Drosophila melanogaster, a very common model organism, the fruit fly, they were able to successfully reproduce under 4-day weightless conditions on the Vostok mission in 1965.
Wow.
For almost as long as we've been in space, we've been trying to get things to fuck up there.
Nice.
I was going to say, that's like 4 years before the moon landing, we were like, you know what also I'm curious about? But I mean, yeah, it's great.
Another really good model organism here. So on the Space Lab International Microgravity Lab, which was sent up by the European Space Agency in 1992, the nematode worm C. elegans reproduced twice, generating thousands of healthy offspring.
Get that out. Wow.
Crickets have also successfully reproduced in space.
Whoa.
But I guess what relates these animals, which makes it hard for us to use them for reproduction research for humans?
They lay eggs?
Yeah. Yeah?
No, not quite. No, although they're invertebrates.
That's pretty fundamental, right there, isn't it?
Oh wow, that's a great point.
So development of their offspring is a lot more simple.
Yeah.
Except for the frogs, right? Frogs are vertebrates. So unless that's a spoiler, that eventually we do get vertebrates.
We have had vertebrates reproduce in space. So in 1998, the Japanese Medeka fish mated successfully during the 15 days of the second International Microgravity Laboratory mission. The fish hatched during the flight. They were healthy, and they went on to produce healthy second-generation offspring on Earth.
Oh,
what happens to space offspring? Like, do they just live in a lab forever after that?
Do they? They belong in a museum. That's amazing. Space fish.
Space fish. Space babies.
Wow. Or maybe they just went to, like, they got a special offer at, like, the best sushi restaurant. Have the first space sushi.
Oh my god.
You could sell that. You could sell that for so much money.
Yeah, you could.
I gotta say, this is blowing my mind. I had no idea that there were animals that had reproduced in space. That's amazing.
I didn't before I started researching this topic. I was just like, oh, I saw a video many years ago on YouTube, which was like, what would happen to a human if they would reproduce in space? And I was like, that video didn't mention any of this stuff. So I'm like, so psyched.
Wow.
Just a quick fun question. Do you know what baby fish are called?
Fry.
And isn't that cute?
Wait, really?
Fish fry, yeah.
I could use a fish fry right now.
And we do have other vertebrates. In 2000, salamander eggs from the species Pleurodiles waltle were fertilized aboard the Russian space station Mir. And they produced...
Can I say, Ella, this gradual step up the evolutionary chain is so fun. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, if they can, then maybe... Oh.
So these salamander embryos developed into larvae, which displayed normal morphology and swimming behavior after landing.
Wow.
Which kind of brings us to the next big question here, which is what happens after birth to space babies? You already actually said it right at the start. I think both of you mentioned this. One of the big ones that we would be concerned about in...
What, about their spine?
Playing with toys?
Yeah, their bones.
Yeah.
Playing with toys.
Bones.
Because, like, neck support, I feel like, would be a weird one for a newborn baby with no gravity.
I feel like neck support wouldn't be that much of an issue because they don't really need to hold their heads up in no gravity.
Oh, that's true, actually, yeah.
Holy wow, huh?
I think one of the issues is what would happen if they were born and grew up in space and then came back to gravity.
That would probably be no bueno. It would be like if we... You could probably do a similar calculation to, like, if we were on a planet that had, like, however much more gravity, right? Like, it would probably suck.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that thing. If we went to 10 times the amount of gravity, we would be so weighed down. Like, we would find it difficult to move because we just don't have the proper mass.
Yeah.
Because proper bone and muscle development requires gravity, basically. You know, it's very well reported that astronauts that have been on the ISS experience, like, some muscle and bone atrophy, even though, like you said, Tom, they have prescribed exercise every day.
Yeah.
So a child born in space would never even be able to develop that initial mass. They would have probably very weak and breakable bones and muscles which couldn't fully function unless you did something in space to counteract this, which you would have to do if you were doing long-term space travel, basically. We always seem to, like, bring animals back from space after they've given birth. We really don't have any examples of animals which are then born and, like, lived their lives out in space.
Yeah.
So we can't say for certain what would happen. But it seems pretty clear that mammals would have issues in bone and muscle development. this is just a fun one. Cosmetically, space babies would look different.
Really?
On Earth, like, our fluids are pulled down by gravity. Which doesn't happen in space. So you get, like, astronauts get, like, these really puffy, fluid-filled faces. So you'd have, like, huge, puffy baby heads. And they're already pretty big.
I was going to say, we need to know scientifically whether babies would be cuter in space, then, is the question.
They'd definitely be chubbier looking.
That's really interesting.
Wow!
So I think the biggest issue I could find, which I didn't predict at all, is...
Oh, boy.
If these babies came back to Earth, would they know which way is up?
What?
I love that that's the question.
Wait. At first I was like, yes, like, but then are you talking about, like, vestibular system calibration and stuff like that?
Exactly.
Holy wow. Because at first I was like, this is a dumb joke that Ella's making. And then I was like, which direction is... Whoa.
So this is so wild to me. The first indicator we had of this was actually in jellyfish. So
what is happening?
So the advantage of sending jellyfish to space is because they have, like, inherent simplicity. So we can find out exactly what's going wrong, what's going on.
What?
So they only have, like, 10,000 neurons diffused across their entire body. Really easy to study.
Sure.
So they have sent jellyfish to space, of course. So two species of jellyfish, Aurelia polyps and Aurelia ephyrae, were exposed to microgravity for 9 days aboard the space shuttle during the SLS-1 mission. Mm-hmm. And they were bred there and their offspring were brought back to Earth. And they had like a much more difficult time orientating themselves and moving than Earth-born jellyfish.
Whoa!
So jellyfish have something called gravitoreceptors. They're like small crystals of calcium sulfate. They're stored in pockets.
There's so much I'm learning. I'm losing my mind. Okay, yeah, sorry.
So they're small crystals of calcium sulfate stored in pockets surrounded by sensitive hair cells. So when the jellyfish move, the crystals like roll to the bottom of the pocket and they tell the hair cells which way is up. The space babies had normal gravitoreceptors. But
Ella, do you hear the words that you're saying? Like the crystals in the jellyfish inner ears from space babies were messed up.
Always struggled to understand how gravitoreceptors work, and the way that you've just explained it to me is like,
yeah.
Oh, good.
I completely understand it now. Thank you so much for that.
Okay. Sorry, I'm digesting it. I'm ready.
Jellyfish don't have ears, so these aren't in their ears like ours, but yeah.
Sure,
The space babies, they had normally developed gravitoreceptors, but researchers think that they weren't calibrated properly, basically.
That makes sense.
But...
oh my god.
Snails born in space.
What the fuck?
I'm losing my mind.
Actually,
we need a comprehensive list of the things that have been taken to space.
It's crazy. It's huge. And this isn't even like most of them.
What the fuck?
Oh my god.
These are just the ones they tried to reproduce in space. They've taken everything to space.
I need to just like recontextualize every image I have of people in space and to realize like probably like there are probably snails like 5 feet off camera somewhere in some container. Like,
for sure there are.
Wow. Okay. Do snails?
Snails born in space like appear to compensate for the lack of gravity. And they do that by growing really large gravitoreceptors, which are more sensitive.
That's amazing!
Yeah, I thought that was so cool. And I really like this.
Oh my
God. So when you bring them back down to Earth and you turn them upside down, they can right themselves a lot more faster than Earth-born snails.
That's so cool!
But it's not always in the right direction. So they're more sensitive, but they can't always tell which way is up.
My heart, my poor heart. But they literally like in anime when they like train in like high gravity hyperbolic chambers, they came back and they had stronger gravity sensors.
Yeah, how it's amazing. So humans actually have a very similar balancing system. And mammals, do you know how it works? You mentioned what it was called, the vestibular system.
I know there's like liquid involved and also hairs. Yeah.
Yes.
I think.
I mean that.
In your ears?
Yeah, it's the inner ear.
Yeah.
That's pretty much like the meat and potatoes of it. Like it's, liquid, hair, and also these crystals. And we also have the ear crystals.
You have ear crystals?
It's a lot more complex than a jellyfish with different parts, but we do contain parts called the utricle and saccule, and they have the fluid and the calcium crystals, which are called canaliths.
Wow.
Which detect motion and orientation. So it obviously kind of raises questions, how would humans deal with gravitational balance issues in space? Mm-hmm. And if a human was born in space, and the closest we've gotten to testing that is with rats.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
And so these were rats that actually went to space. They weren't in the clinostat. So NASA scientist April Ronser sent pregnant rats into orbit for a week.
Oh, wow.
And they came back and gave birth. And they were born normally. But the rats that had been at zero gravity, they just couldn't tell which was the right way up. And they couldn't flip themselves upright when they were dropped in water.
Oh,
poor
things.
Little space babies.
I need a Disney movie for this, please.
Oh my god,
you.
Space babies.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I believe after time they did eventually develop it. But they they hadn't been in space for very long. If they had been born there and stayed there for a longer period of time, it seems like the jellyfish just never developed it. So
yeah,
possibly mammals wouldn't either.
Wow.
There have been speculations by scientists on adaptations that humans would undergo to deal with being born and raised in space. Can you think of what any of those might be?
Make magnetic building blocks so that you can still build towers. Gosh.
I feel like it would either be like with those, with the things in our ears to help us write ourselves.
I feel like over time that would make sense, like the snails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either bigger or way smaller to just like...
Eyeballs? I have no idea.
I think anything you say could be right here because it's so speculative, to be honest. There's a Scott Solomon, who is an evolutionary biologist at Rice University, talked about some of the adaptations he thought humans might undergo. So one of the things that doctors recommend is that women with lower bone density give birth by a C-section.
Okay.
And so there's this idea that if you were to give birth in space, you'd probably give birth by a C-section.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's the easiest way to do it. And so Dr. Solomon says that could lead to larger heads in our descendants because they wouldn't be constrained by the size of the birth canal.
Okay. So this is big speculation. Okay. It's interesting, but like, yeah, that is, they're really thinking like really down
the
line.
Yeah, it's real, like... real speculative. I just thought that was quite interesting. This one, I think, makes more sense to me. He predicted that people living in space may develop darker skin, so more melanin to protect from ultraviolet radiation.
Oh, right. Wow.
Oh,
wow.
That's a much better one.
That makes sense. Oh, yeah. God, that's so many things.
I think that there is a little bit of evidence for this. This is completely speculation on my part. Because I've linked these two things, but the first animal to conceive and give birth in space was a Russian cockroach called Nadezhda.
I'm sorry. Okay, I just gotta get used to these words coming out of your mouth. I'm sorry.
I feel like we just got over the rats, and now we have to deal with a little cockroach named Nadezhda.
This was in 2007, so it was a lot later. But she like was conceived, carried, and gave birth. Like she did all the processes. And she was aboard the satellite Photon M3 in September 2007. And her 33 offspring were healthy and had a normal life cycle. But their carapaces darkened and coloured much, much faster than compared to Earth-born cockroaches.
That's amazing.
I may be completely wrong on that. I read that and I was like, oh, maybe that's related to the... protection from radiation.
It's a really interesting thought, isn't it?
This is also how you know that depictions of aliens aren't real, because they're all gray and pale, when in reality, clearly, they would have much darker skin.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason why.
I'm coming to the end now. I have a couple more questions. Why are we doing all of these studies?
Because it's amazing!
I assume because at some point we're gonna want to do big old space travel, and that is probably going to entail having birth in space.
Yeah, that's a pretty much the answer, right?
Oh, wow.
It's associated mainly right now with long-term human habitation of Mars.
Yeah.
So Mars has a much lower gravity than Earth, so it's just how would we develop on Mars specifically? And then with that, what do you think is the next step to actually studying this, to understanding how humans would fare with space birth?
It's really tough because you don't want to immediately go down the, like, get humans to do it route. The amount of, like, ethical issues that there are with that and just sort of seeing what happens.
Can I ask, what about a moon baby? Because it's a lower gravity. And, you know, I mean, if we're thinking so far in the future, you could establish more resources on a physical thing than, like, the ISS.
But you're thinking humans, right?
Yes.
Not humans first.
Yeah. I mean,
probably.
I think the one thing that's been like quite a theme through all of this is that they often just do parts. They just do one individual part of this in space.
Right, right. That has been the clever part. Yeah.
They fertilize or they deliver or whatever.
Right.
Very rarely go through the processes, and they don't go through like full life cycles.
Right.
So NASA's Langley Research Center has designed an experiment to study the long-term effects of partial gravity on mammalian reproduction. This is from an article in National Geographic. Before significant investment is made in capabilities leading to such pioneering efforts, the challenges of multi-generational mammalian reproduction in a partial gravity environment needs to be investigated. The scientists write, humans may encounter reproductive challenges in gravity environments different than Earth's, as gravitational forces may disrupt mammalian life cycle processes and actively shape genomes in ways that are inheritable. So this study they've developed would have a mouse colony in lunar orbit, so yeah, the moon.
Yay!
In a rotating habitat that could be observed and operated almost completely autonomously.
It would be a little rat moon for the moon.
Yeah. Aww. They have 600 cameras set up, telerobotic animal care, and it would look at least 3 generations of mice a year, with scientists keeping track of birth rates and overall animal health.
See, Caroline, you called the Disney movie way too soon. This is the Disney movie. This is the shit, right here for a Disney film.
The mouse moon on the moon.
You get a little Ratatouille cameo. You get a little Wall-E cameo. It writes itself.
I feel like we need to copyright this idea before someone steals it.
Yeah, we can't release this. We're not releasing this episode, actually.
So silly. They have planned this, like, quite specifically, because they would have a human habitat in lunar space that the mouse colony would, like, rendezvous with once a year to receive samples and perform maintenance, and the goal would be to run the experiment for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
And they want to do it prior to the late 2020s. I don't know how realistic that is.
What, start it before that point?
Yeah, so that they could, before they send people to Mars, basically.
Well, we got time before that, in my opinion.
Yeah,
that's a question for another time.
In my opinion, too, but if they want to know about this kind of stuff, they have to start quite soon, because it just takes so long to do this research.
Oh, yeah. And I gotta say, that, for me, has been the most mind-blowing part of all of this so far, is just, like, the experiment design is, like, it's, like, regular experiment design, like, to a thousandfold, because, like, the resources needed, like, you don't get, like, a second try to get mice in space, right?
No,
and
yeah.
Also, you are planning for, like, circumstances that are so new. It really absolutely boggles my mind, and they're all so clever. It's really...
Yeah.
The thought that goes into it is amazing. But I really think that the main issue, and you guys have both touched on it, is that what needs to happen is human studies.
Hmm.
Human reproduction is so different from other mammals.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I touched on it in my episode about periods. The way human embryos implant and grow is different from almost every other animal on Earth, bar 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what we need a human embryo to be artificially fertilized and partially grown in space. And then we just need humans to try and reproduce in space. But then, of course, we run into, like, crazy ethical issues.
Yeah,
course,
at that point.
Of course.
James Nodler of the Houston Fertility Clinic said, if you look at early IVF studies, they skipped over a lot of mouse and primate studies. It's just not the same. It can't be overstated that at some point we have to do human studies to see what's really going on there. So if we are ever going to live on Mars, first we got to throw some babies into space.
That's so interesting.
Well, most importantly, people have to bone in space.
Yeah. Just pick up a random baby and take it to space. Like, I mean, I don't think you're going to get away with that. Whose baby are you going to steal, Tom? Huh?
I'm sure lots of people would sacrifice themselves to bone in space.
Who wouldn't? Like,
no, but I bet if you said to some people, you won't come back alive, though, they'd be like, yep, fine, whatever.
True. Very true. People definitely would.
Going out with a bang.
That's actually the end of my section, and I don't have a nice thing to close it off with, because this is just, like, so weird. It's all so weird.
It's so...
I think, like, the point that it's left on of just, like, you kind of have to deal with whatever icks it might give you to deal with human testing in some capacity. Like, it's okay for that to make you go, ooh, I don't know how I feel about that.
It is.
You know, and to just sit with that feeling for a second. Yeah.
Walking through the process of this reminds me very much of the process of any drug development on Earth. It's the same animals, the same processes, and eventually it has to move into a place you're less comfortable with, like human testing.
Yeah,
or maybe
definitely.
Even the earlier stages, some people would be less comfortable with that, like in other mammals.
I will also say it's really interesting what this teaches us about pregnancy and life on Earth, because, like... when you, like, it shows you, like, what you take for granted, like gravity, right? Like that some things aren't a given. And so it teaches us equally as much about what the development of life is like on Earth when you try to compare it to what it could be like outside of Earth.
Yeah, that's such
a really good point. It shows, I think looking at all the different animals, the ones that are successful and not, shows us how specifically humans or mammals are like are adapted to Earth.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that, like, how much evolution really does. It's
holy moly.
It kind of proves it, doesn't it, almost? Of like, yeah, obviously we've evolved to have, like, gravity specific to this planet so that our babies can know the right way up on this one planet. Yeah.
So they're ear crystals.
Obviously, the right way up thing is a different scenario, but not every animal, like, for example, less evolved animals have an much easier time reproducing in space than we do.
Great point. That's so...
so interesting.
Yeah, this whole thing has been so fun to read. I'm just going to... Actually, I will leave you on one point. And while I was doing this research, I came across an article on the NASA website, which is about studying the behavior of mice in microgravity. So I believe these mice are on the NASA flight habitat. And there's a video here.
Oh boy. We'll throw this link in the show notes.
Oh, and these are mice in their little space cage. And apparently they adapt really well to microgravity. It's so cute.
Wow.
They're like floating. Their little butts are like floating in the air.
They're like grabbing the edges of the cage to like move around.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was fully expecting them to just be like wobbling free in space, but like they're vibing. Like honestly, if you showed this, it would take a second for anyone to know that this is in space, even.
And like there's a moment, I don't know if you got to it, Tom, where like one of them's holding on to the bottom of the cage with its back legs and grooming with its front legs normally, which is so cool.
So grooming behavior is in mice as a sign that they're like comfortable.
They're literally running around the cage. This is amazing. This is one of the best videos I've ever seen.
At 1 minute and 22 seconds into this video, the mice are absolutely fucking going to town on the zero gravity.
Like literally Sonic the Hedgehog running a loop.
Yeah.
They're running in circles like they're on a wheel, but just floating about. It's so cute. And they look like they're having an absolute ball.
This is amazing.
Wow.
Anyway, they adapted really well and they look so cute doing it. And apparently they were fine. They just, they came back and they were happy and they were healthy. So.
I'm so glad.
Aww.
Just amazing. Thought,
I'm so glad they were thriving. That makes me so happy.
Mice thrive in space, man.
Basically, we're going to end up infesting another planet with mice because we've accidentally
got because of
got
all the
them.
Cheese on the moon, of course.
Duh, yeah.
Duh.
There's going to be no moon left.
And one of the useful things about this study of these mice is that mice will like naturally adapt. They don't. We have to think about these things, and they naturally like found ways to anchor themselves to eat and to groom and to move.
Yeah.
And so
that's
it was like, oh,
really
watching them to see how their natural adaptations can be put into human, like, mechanical adaptations for us.
So cool. So smart.
Yeah, so good. I love space. Oh, no. What's wrong?
What is wrong, Tom? You sound so down.
Why are you so sad?
It's just that I've finished all the episodes of my favorite podcast, and I wish there was more I could listen to and a way I could support them, but sadly, that's not the case.
Oh, but wait, Tom. There is.
What?
You can do that on Patreon.
Ooh. Patreon? What's that?
Patreon? No, I can't.
No, that's fine.
Patreon is a site where you can support us for as little as $1 a month. And at higher tiers, you can get great extra content like us taking science tests from other countries, slumber party games, Twilight film commentary, and more.
Including extra clips from the show and behind the scenes content. All of that for only $3 a month. And I've heard that at higher tiers, you get to vote on the bonus content that gets made.
Yes, you do. And you can find all of the information at letsleareverythingpod.com.
That's letsleareverythingpod.com.
That's amazing. Guys, I wasn't talking about our show. I was talking about...
Oh.
Why would I be talking about our show?
Oh, that's true. Why would you... give us Why money.
Yeah, I was talking about Dungeons and Daddies. It's a good D&D podcast. They do have Patreon.
Valid.
That's good. That's
oh,
good.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Today's miscellaneous topic is going to be about the history of nail varnish. So the first thing I wanted to ask both of you is, do you two wear nail varnish? I don't know why I went so high then. Just like, do you two wear nail varnish?
So
Tom, I feel like you do. I feel like I've seen you wear nail varnish. Have I made that up in my head?
You have, but I do like it. So
oh, you look like, you seem like you'd look good in nail varnish.
Yeah, you do, definitely.
God, flustered. So I think this is also a Britishism and a US Americanism, is
nail
that we
polish.
Call it nail polish.
Yes, yeah, and I will be referring to it as both of those things.
Okay.
Today, yeah.
But the real question is, which will we use for the title? We'll decide that. We'll fight after this.
Yeah, it would be. Nah, we don't have to fight. It's polish. The difference is British people and anyone in the English speaking world is so used to Americanisms that we can deal with both. If Americans see it, the other version, they're like, what? What's happening here?
Yeah. I saw a TikTok and it was this this person had done like a rebuttal on somebody's post and somebody had commented on that post, if you're gonna take the piss out of someone or something along those lines, if you're gonna like berate someone, you could at least spell color right. It's C-O-L-O-R. And I was like, oh no.
American. Also, very funny that even in your American impersonation, you said take the piss out.
Yeah, the best way was berate them. But
I don't want to alienate our American audience. You're the good ones.
Oh god. Okay.
Okay.
Back on track.
Yeah,
back on track.
It's
about nail polish.
I sometimes wear nail polish, but only very rarely, and as I feel I'm forced to in my gender role.
What a mood.
I was gonna say, yeah, and I'm sure we're gonna talk about all kinds of gender stuff, but like, it's I quite enjoy it. I've only had it a handful of times, but in the times that I have had it done, it's usually been like a friend of mine who does it to me. And I find that one of the most therapeutic and just like nice things. I remember I was in a long-term relationship and I had my significant other did it a few times to me, like painted my nails. And then like post the traumatic breakup, I very distinctly remember one of my best friends being like, do you want me to do it? And I'm gonna be like,
that's really sweet.
And so I, you know, because I do it less frequently because there's less social gender obligation. I do like it. I also want to say really quickly, Caroline, I think this might take the cake for the most small miscellaneous topic ever. And so I'm very excited to like take this like literally physically tiny thing and take a deep dive into it.
This is smaller than stamps, I guess, just by a fraction.
Well, stamps was
well, that was stickers.
Stickers.
So even that,
stickers can be huge, whereas nail polish is literally just on your nails.
Caroline is wearing beautiful yellow. I really
like
this color.
I always wear yellow nail polish if I can, because it makes me happy. Yeah, but it's really, really chipped right now. Yeah, so if I show you guys, it's so horrendous.
Oh, that is pretty bad.
Yeah, it's really bad because I'm also a picker. So
can I just ask, is yellow your favorite color?
It is, yeah.
Because I saw a TikTok which is like, it showed a color and it was like, this is your, you know, personality type if this is your favorite color, and it did yellow at the end. It showed yellow and it was like, depressed.
called out,
I mean,
by TikTok.
Well,
there, I mean, is
yeah,
it wrong?
They're not wrong on that one.
Yeah.
Caroline, this is so, I don't know why I do this because it doesn't affect you at all, but I do want you to know, when I edit the audio, I make your track yellow. Because you can change the colors
so
in
that
logic.
Makes me so happy.
It doesn't affect you when I do it.
No, but it makes me, now I feel good. Oh,
yellow's actually also my favorite color, but I'll let you have the yellow track.
Guys, it's mine too.
This is so cute.
Oh my gosh.
What a cute episode.
This is the energy of nail polish.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm
so sorry. We're
this
so
this out
off
enough.
Topic. Do your thing.
This is the missed topic. This is the place.
Okay, so first off, since we've all worn a little bit of nail polish, I want to talk about how much the nail polish market is worth.
Any guesses? Any takers on how much money?
2 billion.
I'd say like 10.
Ding, ding,
ding. I could
be
wrong. I have no idea.
$10 billion as of 2020. That is estimated to double by 2027.
And that's
holy.
That's based on like 5 women who have every nail varnish colour under the sun. I swear to God, people I know into nail varnish have like, you either have a shit ton of it or you have none. And that's like the only options.
Well, come on. You know, there's the goth market that supplies the black nail polish industry.
Yeah, but they have like 100 shades of black. So.
Oh my God, yeah. 100%. They are looking for the perfect black that only takes like one coat on. Yeah. Ooh. So some estimates suggest that around 70% of women regularly wear nail polish. Although almost impossible to accurately estimate that number, so take that with a large pinch of salt.
Sure, yeah.
But we do know that a lot of people wear nail polish. Mm-hmm. I also really like wearing it. I'm not somebody who has, like, shelves of the stuff. I have, like, 5 bottles that I religiously use. But that meant that I wanted to know a bit more about its history. So let's dive on into it. When do you think people first started colouring in their nails?
This is really interesting, because again, it really, I feel like this has got to be old-ish, because it's just paint on nails, and it's a timeless look.
Absolutely.
It's going to be real, it's going to be like, I'm guessing the sticker era, the face sticker era, because that's also when high heels started coming around, and it was men that wore them.
That's interesting.
Ah, so if you take the idea of nail polish out of it, so it's not just like nail polish or nail varnish, like just coloring your nails in general.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Was there like a war, like, you know, black or red?
Ooh. I mean, I can totally imagine this being a thing in like ancient Asia or something like that. Also,
I'm going earlier.
Yeah,
real early with it.
I'm saying like
10,000 BC.
Oh, okay.
So it is a really, really long time ago. Some historians believe that people have been colouring their nails using one form or another since around 5,000 BC.
Wow!
Wow.
Oh, so like we just learned, as far back as the historical record
Pretty much,
goes.
Yeah. As far back as we have dated records of things, people have been colouring in their nails.
How do we know that people weren't
Good
doing
grief.
It before that then?
We don't. Basically,
we just have records for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Because I mean, I don't think nail polish survives. I don't think even nails survive decomposition.
No.
Right?
There's things like evidence of Babylonian people coloring in their nails, especially like men using something called kohl.
K-O-H-L.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was also what women and men used on their eyes.
Yes, yeah.
Oh.
But every article that I read about painting your nails in some way basically claimed that a different place originated the practice, which is really, really funny. So Babylonian is one group that is often said to have started it. Ancient China is another one where we do know that in ancient China, dyeing your nails deep red colours was very, very popular was actually a status symbol as well, of being able to dye your nails these deep colours. They'd use things like beeswax, gelatin, egg whites, gum arabic, etc. Oh. And mix it in with a dye component of some sort, such as roses or orchids.
Oh.
And they'd leave this paste on their fingers for a few hours, basically to dye their fingernails a certain colour.
It's kind of like henna.
I'm going to bring up henna in a second as well, actually, because henna is something else that people used to use to, not only to, like, dye their fingernails, but people have been using that to colour their skin for a really, really long time.
It's amazing because, you know, I feel like with some of these things where we, like, go far back, like, it has changed so much, right? Because, like, with stickers, right, it was the ancient Egyptians were using, like, paste ads, right?
Yeah.
But, like, like functionally identical. It's to make your nails look a nice color.
It's exactly that, yeah. Obviously there's a lot more like cultural reasons at the time it, but like it's essentially the same thing of like,
God, fashion trends always recycle.
I think it was the Han Dynasty was popularized bell-bottom jeans. I think, if I remember right.
So there are literally claims that if you weren't somebody who was in a position of power of some sort and you tried to dye your nails these red colours, it was a crime. And there are reports of people, if you wore the same colour as the royal family was dyeing their nails at the time, which did change, like, over time, it was potentially punishable by death.
Oh, come on.
It's really, really serious.
One of us needs to change by dying.
It wasn't just colours that were used as a status symbol. The length of your nail was as well. Can you guys think about why the length of the nail might have been important?
Is it because if you have long nails and you that means you don't need to do any physical labor yourself, that other people are doing it for
it's
you?
It's exactly that.
It's the same as being pale. You know, you haven't been out in the sun, so pale skin was
fashionable.
That's going
to come up in a second as well. Yeah. Especially in the Victorian era, that was a really big thing in, like, nails. I'll talk about it all in a second. It's really interesting. So somebody called Suzanne E. Shapiro is the author of a book called Nails, The Story of the Modern Manicure. And she said in her book that noblemen and noblewomen of the Yuan dynasty often had very, very long nails and donned long, ornately decorated claw-like nail guards.
Oh, I've definitely seen these in, like, movies and stuff.
Yeah. So they would wear these in pairs, so they'd have two per hand, and it would protect the long nails underneath. And that was essentially a symbol of being, like, able to say, oh, I didn't have to lift a
finger. I'll be honest. There's something about this that just really grosses me out. Like,
oh yeah,
it's icky,
your long,
isn't it?
Creepy nails. Yeah. Like, oh god.
That's fascinating, though.
So there's another famous story of an ancient ruler doing something somewhat similar, which is actually Cleopatra, who it's rumored that she used to dye her, like, the tips of her fingers and her nails blood red using henna. And that was supposedly to symbolize her power, and apparently if anybody else dared try to dye their nails the same color, they would also be executed.
There's something very cool about imagining, like, the tips of someone's fingers being red. Like, there's something aesthetically very cool about that.
The issue with this story is that even though it's quite famous, and actually quite a few of the articles that I read about this claimed it to be a fact, it's not true, unfortunately. Aww. It's a really, really good story. And it is true that people have used henna to dye their nails since at least 5000 BC throughout parts of India, South Asia, North Africa, as well as in ancient Egypt. People did do this. We just don't have any proof that people like Cleopatra or Nefertiti did this. We do know that mummified pharaohs have been found with their fingers dyed with henna, including their fingernails.
That's cool. That's so cool. Well, so it's possible that Cleopatra could have done it.
Yes, there's just no evidence to suggest that she did
do it. For
this
story.
Yeah.
Wow. Literally, mummies having
so
dyed nails.
So interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And there are stories of various armies dying, like, again, Babylonian men, like, painting their nails black as an intimidation effect, things like that.
Yeah, that's what I said.
So, yeah, basically, just a whole load of people were doing whatever they could to make their nails very, very pretty colours.
Nice.
For as long as we've been wearing makeup, essentially, we've been doing a similar thing to our nails, which is really, really cool. So all of this was very, very popular. It became very common throughout a lot of parts of the world, probably around until the fall of the Roman Empire, where it just fell out of fashion, basically. So a lot of the world was still doing it, especially in, like,
that was the real worst part about the fall of the Roman Empire. Yeah.
The Europeans losing their nail varnish. Oh my god, no. So obviously various parts of the world were still, like, dyeing their fingers with henna and things like that. It just was less common to such a broad extent.
Sure.
And the use of, like, colouring your nails was then revived again when trading became bigger between Europe and parts of India and various parts of the Middle East. European aristocracy basically would take all of the nail polishes that they could find. Nail polish is a very loose term for things that they would use to colour in their nails here. But it still took a really, really long time for it to become popular throughout the rest of Europe because it was expensive. Mm. Buying the dyes was really, really difficult for somebody who didn't have a lot of money. So it was limited to aristocracy, like royal courts, especially in France, where
at the time, French fashion was getting more and more outlandish, so did nails and things like that.
Nice.
I think that's something I always forget to not take for granted is the fact that, like, dyes and colors were, like...
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
You had to, like, get them from specific things that only had that color.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were significantly more valuable as opposed to now there's, like... dozens and dozens and dozens of colors I can go to CVS down the street.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that why purple was like a royalty color? Because purple it was harder to produce.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why, like, in a lot of oil paintings especially, like, things that were meant to be blue have faded so much because people used essentially less good quality blue paints to make their artwork. So if you see an old painting which is good quality blue, the artist will have spent basically their life savings trying to get that blue pigment.
I have a top fact about this. This is this exact thing relates to Van Gogh. So people think still to this day it's like perpetuated that he was colorblind.
Yeah.
But there's a very clear evidence he probably wasn't. That it's just the specific blues in his paintings, or is it the reds? I can't remember.
Well, possibly
one color
both.
has faded because he wasn't very rich. He didn't have a lot of money, so he used less good quality paints. If you look under the frame in some of his pictures where the light hasn't touched the painting, see like the colors are preserved a lot better.
So interesting.
So it is very unlikely that he was actually colorblind.
Yeah.
I do remember that episode of Doctor Who where they bring Van Gogh back and he looks at his painting and he's like,
oh, it looks shit.
The colors. Ooh, kind of blue. Gosh, that blue really shouldn't have cheaped out on that blue. Oh, sucks.
So yeah, so that's why like so many people didn't have all of these nail colorings and things
Makes
like
sense.
That. It didn't really become commonly used until around the 18th century. That's when we know it was like a very commonly used cosmetic product in places like France at the time. The Victorian era came in and changed trends in nail fashion once again, because the Victorian era tended to lean towards like almost purity culture and being much more reserved and conservative in the way that you presented yourself.
In the West, I assume that people were still doing all kinds of stuff elsewhere.
Absolutely, yes. So all of this like purity culture and being a lot more conservative with how you presented also translated into nail fashion. So the author that I mentioned previously stated in her book that in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a woman showed a well-mannered sophistication by tending to her soft, natural-looking hands. According to an 18th century English list of qualities denoting the perfect female beauty...
Oh my God.
It listed a white hand, somewhat long and plump, and nails of mother-of-pearl turned oval-wise. So basically pale nails. So it
oh
is that
gosh.
Idea.
So like down to the nail.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So what were they using for that? Do you know?
So they weren't necessarily using like colours on their nails. They would be buffing their nails quite a lot to make them very rounded, very soft, very shiny as well. Some people would use things like rose oils and essential oils to give a slight tint to the nails to make them look healthier. But
well, to be fair, there was no TV, so what else do you do but buff your nails?
I was going to say, like, my top 10 features, nails is, like, number one. My gosh.
But people spent, like, especially people who had a bit more money and a bit more time, would spend a lot of time attending to their nails and doing all of that buffing and shining and shaping and things like that. And because there was so much time being spent on it, people wanted basically quicker ways of getting this done or maybe paying somebody else to do it. And that's how the first manicure parlour came into existence.
Oh.
It was established by a lady named Mary Cobb, who went to France to learn manicure skills, basically, and then processed that information, came back to America, and set up her first manicure shop in 1876.
Wow, that's a lot earlier than I would have expected.
It's really early, isn't it? Yeah, so she would do things like buffing and shaping the nails, potentially adding those tints to the nails. But again, it wasn't anything like adding these really bright colours that we think about now when we have nail polish. Also really interestingly, Mary Cobb created the first at-home manicure guide and supposedly created the first emery board as well, which is what people use to file down their nails.
Yeah.
So all of that is attributed to her. I previously mentioned that some articles I read about this topic had some like incorrect or annoying pieces of information. So this is a dishonorable mention by a website called Sienna, who said of Cobb, her $1.25 buff and shine manicures set her up as a successful female entrepreneur. A girl boss even, and I read that and I had to shut the website.
That's horrible.
It was awful. It was so bad.
Wow, Mary Cobb, girl boss.
A girl boss, if you will. Because she was like...
It does sound like a great story, I will say. Like, it's cool.
Her story is fantastic. And I would recommend anybody who wants to read a bit more about Mary Cobb, please do. Because she ended up setting up, I think it's something like 1,000 parlors across America. Wow. She really was a very, very incredible entrepreneur. Yeah.
Because a this girl was, boss, if you will.
A girl boss, if you will.
But if you will, really. Oh.
Yeah, that was really bad. But she was an incredible woman who did really, really well for herself, all by pampering people's nails because they couldn't be bothered to do it at home. And that's sort of how nail polish became a thing as well, which is really fun. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite at nail polish yet. There's one more step, which is a company called Cutex, which anybody listening, I don't think Ella and Tom recognize it, but if you're listening and you do recognize it, that's because it's still operating as a nail brand over 100 years later, which is really, really cool. Mm. So they established in 1911 with just one product, which was a product to soften cuticles around the nail bed, basically helping you remove excess skin. Again, making you be able to have that like soft, supple look to your hands. Very lovely.
I'm spending quite a lot of this whole thing looking at my nails.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
yep.
Colourless liquid nail polish itself was also introduced to the Cutex line in 1916.
So early.
And the whole point of that was it was literally just a clear see-through nail polish that people could apply to the top of the nails to make it look shiny so that they didn't have to spend hours buffing them at home to make them look shiny by hand.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that was like one of the earliest forms of a nail varnish or a nail polish. There was another one added to the line in 1917, which had a rose tint to it. But coloured nail polishes or coloured nail varnishes would be added to the line very, very soon after this point. But they were sort of not relying on, but something else was discovered or something else was developed first, which meant that they were able to make nail varnish.
Okay.
Do you guys have any idea what could have been developed which could then help nail varnish be created?
Cosmic rays.
I wish that would have tied this in together very nicely.
Is it a paint technology?
Yeah.
Car paint.
Yes! Car paint!
Nice!
No. Yeah! No!
We had to wait for car paint to become a thing before we got nail polish. Absolutely, yes.
What? I can't believe I guess that. Because in my head, I was like, what looks the most like nail varnish? It's definitely car paint.
It's exactly that. So there's a compound in it called nitrocellulose, which is a key ingredient in nail varnish, which was initially used in car paint in the 1920s. So once that became a thing, people sort of used it as inspiration. There's another story about how people saw glossy car paint and wanted that on their nails. And even stories of women using car paint to paint their nails.
Wow.
So
I would never have made that connection. That's wild.
It's such a good one, isn't it? So basically we have car paint to thank for the creation of colourful nail cosmetics, which is really, really cool. So in 1924, Cutex introduced its first line of colourful nail varnishes, and it was a line of purely pink nail varnish, which, gender norms, am I right? So fun.
Am I right?
Wait, when was it?
That was 1924.
Weren't pink and blue the other way around then, I thought?
I don't know, to be honest. I just know that it was pinks at
pink
the time.
Pink was originally a boy colour.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably around that time that it got shifted over, so it could have still been...
with the rise of makeup and cosmetics and things as well, all happened at around the same sort of time.
Pink is also sort of like it's still like a natural-ish color for male, right? It's not like a...
What I do know is that red then got introduced about 5 years later in 1929 to this line. So they had to deal with pink for 5 years, and then you get reds after that. So, like, introducing the colors still took a considerable amount of time, even after nail varnish was introduced.
That is interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know why that's the case.
Yeah, you would think it would be just like we can do any, why not? Mm-hmm. But that also does make sense that it would take a,
I guess if there's no demand for it, then why would you make it?
I mean, yeah,
right?
That's a good point.
Yeah. Revlon launched its first line of long-lasting nail polishes in 1932. And finally, you get black nail polish in the 1930s as well. So again, possibly nearly up to a decade after nail varnishes and nail polishes became an actual thing, you then get black nail polish.
That's a while. That's a lot longer.
It's a long time, isn't it? Yeah. It's also suggested that around that time, nail art, in the sense of using nail polish to paint tiny little things onto your nails, became a thing. Obviously, people were using things like henna to create very intricate designs on their nails for far longer than this. But there's a really interesting story about how somebody tried to paint a full landscape in the UK just on their nails in the 1930s. So that's pretty cool. I quite like that.
Yeah, that's cute.
So that's basically like a very brief history of nail polishes and things like that. Obviously, as the decades go on, styles in nail polishes change. In the 40s, it was very famous to have more red nails, and at the same time have like shorter, more subtle nails as women entered the workforce a lot more, which is really, really interesting. There was the creation of the French tip in the 1970s, which is that almost pale nail with very, very white tip at the end, which I think everybody recognises. Yeah. And now it's becoming more mainstream for everybody of all genders to be wearing nail polish, particularly after lockdown, where a lot of men were allowing their partners to paint their nails, be it out of curiosity or out of boredom, things like that. But now it's more popular than it possibly ever has been, apart from in ancient civilizations, to paint your nails as a man, which is really lovely. I feel like for the miscellaneous topics, we always have like a nice little final message of like togetherness and inclusion, a hobby bringing everybody together from every walk of life, whether it's to watch somebody speed running or creating a video game in a ridiculously small amount of time.
But
I could do that with nail varnish, but I'm not gonna fucking do that because, quite frankly, it's painting your nails. Like, my final message is to don't be a fucking dick. If somebody wants to paint their nails and they do not, and it does not conform to the idea of gender identity that you've got,
I stand by this. This rules, yeah.
Shut up. Just shut up. Nobody cares. Let people paint their nails. Nobody cares about your shitty opinion. Just let people do what they want to do. That's it.
Yep.
That's the end of my little spiel. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Caroline. Yes, I really, that end point is exquisite.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's a really beautiful point to think that it is as popular now as it might have been like in ancient times.
I like that. Really, or at least that it could get to that point soon. Like,
yeah,
I think there still is quite a lot of stigma around it, but we are getting a lot better, and a lot of very famous men are painting their nails now, which is really, really wonderful. People like Lil Nas X and stuff, who you see regularly. And actually the rise of like K-pop and J-pop seems to promoted that as well.
I would really like to bring back from all of these trends is painting your nails for intimidation tactics in war.
You know what? I agree. Wasn't that fun?
I'm going to do that.
What is your go-to nail polish colours?
No, I don't have a... Don't do it. No, it's not like... I think it would look good. You know, I think about nail colours all the time, but I'm really lazy.
Oh, yeah. It takes a while. How many nail polishes do you own, Ella?
Five. Yeah, that's like the bare minimum requirement as a cisgendered woman.
My go-to, I love black.
I knew you were gonna say black.
Oh yeah.
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 It's been a long time, honestly. I should do it again.
What's stopping you from going to, like, a drugstore and buying some nail polish? Well, you know
what it is. It's the same progression. And maybe it'll be a good thing. Because, like, it started off because I was in a relationship with a person. And then it moved to letting my friends do it. And then I think the final evolution is letting myself do it just because I like to. Because it's nice.
You should.
I also think it's just, like, a nice way to decompress and think about nothing else, or to just have like something on in the background and do it.
And for me, and maybe this is like a super obvious observation from someone who's new to it, but it's just like throughout the day, I'll just like look at my hands and be like, oh yeah, nice.
That's yeah. What I like about
All right, come on, lads, stop talking about your nails.
Oh, but mom.
Mom.
Oh, not yet.
Wait, shh, 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 guys. Guys, do you hear that sound?
Oh? What is that? What's that sound?
What's happening?
That sounds like Review Corner.
Oh, it's... I think it is.
Oh my goodness.
Is that the call of the rare Review Corner bird? I can hear it. So, today's review comes from Fred's PC House Calls. and they go, one episode and I was hooked!
Yeah.
All caps.
Aww.
Let's learn everything. Not even once, kids. LLE only needed one episode and I was totally hooked. The hosts do an amazing job at keeping things understandable and engaging. It never comes off as anyone talking down to you, and they seem like kind people who you'd be absolutely over the moon to be friends with in real life.
It's not true.
Fred.
I'm sorry, it is true.
I guarantee you will be entertained and you will definitely learn a thing or two if you listen to this very special podcast.
Thank you, Fred.
So thanks, Fred. Do y'all have any plugs or shoutouts?
I will shout out myself, Big Science Energy, on TikTok, Ella Hubba on Twitter, and also CGTRM on TikTok, where I make TikToks where I work. And they're quite good, actually.
I think they're great.
You can follow me everywhere. I'm just Caroline the Bug. Nice and easy.
And I'm Tom Lum Person everywhere you get podcasts. And everywhere on the internet. So, today...
Wait, sorry, Tom, do you have your own podcast?
So, today we learned about all the different sciences that contribute to carbon dating. We learned about all the various animals that have had space babies, and what that means about having babies and what that means about space. And we have learned about the 7,000-year-old history of nail polish, and that if you like doing it, you do it. And you can all join us next time where we will learn about
everything. Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubba, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum. Okay, hold, I'm so sorry. I'm just going to get a tissue.
Okay, don't say content. I can't say anything. Ella's not here. That is going to be super funny. No, I can't. It'll ruin
it. Keep it in, Tom. Oh, hi, Al.
Oh, no. Were you being mean?
Always.
No, I was saying while Ella's gone, I can't say content. Because we gotta keep it for the pod.
Oh, I see.
I'm just a content machine, baby. Jokes left and right.
Yeah, I guess so.
Nail polish. More like... Oh, were you waiting for some...
Wait, were you not doing a joke then?
No, I was just saying nail polish.
Great. Oh my
right
god.
Then.
It's a good thing you're editing this.
Yeah. I was gonna say the exact same thing, Al. I was literally gonna say, I'm so glad.